Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Stephen St. John and Nate Bucati. Now joined by our college basketball insider from the Sporting News, Mike DeCourcy. You can follow him on Twitter. TSN Mike is his handle. Mike, good morning. How are you?
I am well, Stephen. How are you?
Very well, but I'm awful leery of you this week, Mr. Pittsburgh. Mr. Pittsburgh Steelers! What do you think about this matchup?
Your fault.
Well, I know everything's my fault, but we've asked you about the Steelers.
Not you specifically. Not you specifically. Right. I'd say whoever was guarding Jamar Chase, but, you know.
Yeah, no kidding. Hmm. Were you? So how did you? Well, they weren't defending him,
yeah,
apparently.
Nobody was, Mike.
That's the problem. So how did you, what was going through your mind watching that game between the Raiders and the Chargers, knowing that Pittsburgh's postseason life was depending on that not ending in a tie, and it looked like it was almost going to end in a tie?
Well, you know, Sunday night is most often when we air Big Ten basketball and beyond at Big Ten Network. And on Sunday night, we had a game between Wisconsin and Maryland that we had a post game show for, and then we went straight into Beyond. So the beginning of the Chargers Raiders game was on while we were working the Wisconsin-Maryland game. So I wasn't paying much attention to it because, one, I was working, and, two, I didn't care who won. I just wanted somebody to win.
Right.
I was joking. I was rooting for a safety because, like, you know, hard to match that, you know. So then I went into the studio, and we had the post-game show, went straight into Big Ten and Beyond. And so I was in the studio for about 2 hours. Just about, and I told myself I had my phone because I use the app, a score app, for stats and stuff sometimes in between breaks, and so I told myself I'm not checking the score because I didn't want the distraction and the pressure and all that. I wanted to focus on what I'm supposed to be doing, and so I didn't check it at all. And then we had one segment left in Beyond, and so I'm like, okay, it's like 11 o'clock Eastern. I think I can check it now. So I look at the app, and it's 29-14 with, like, 4.5 minutes left. And I'm like, we're in.
You feel great. Like, you love it.
No way, right? Who scores 29 points one team, let alone two teams? You know? Like, that's, like, probably one of the least hit numbers in terms of a final score of everything, of every number under 30. That's probably one of the two or three least hit numbers, and yet both teams hit it. So then when the overtime was happening, you know, I, like I said, don't care who wins, doesn't matter, just want somebody to win. And when they tied after the first two possessions, I really started to worry. And when the Raiders started running the ball instead of throwing it all because they didn't want to give up a pick six, then I really started to worry. And thank goodness for the fact that the Chargers all of a sudden couldn't stop the run, because if it weren't for that, I don't have grand Super Bowl ambitions for this team, but I felt like after what they did on Sunday that the Steelers at least deserved to appear in the playoffs, and that, you know, the unlikely scenario of another tie would have been a heck of a way to end that.
I mean, that's such a wild way to end the season. With that ball in the air on that field goal attempt, it's, you know, Pittsburgh, whether or not the Chargers make it, the opponent for the Chiefs, all that's up in the air with the football during that field goal attempt. And so then, because if it was a tie, the Chiefs would have played the Raiders. But since it wasn't, now they play the Steelers. And so before we move, you know, on to college basketball, you see Pittsburgh way more than we have. And so you tell me what you expect to happen on Sunday night when these teams rematch?
Well, I don't have, like I said, great Super Bowl ambitions, and I will say that of all the teams that are in the AFC field, the one that I would have least wanted to play was the one they'll play. because defending the Chiefs is so very difficult. Especially, you know, the Steelers' run defense has been hampered by the absence of Stephon Tuitt, who's a Pro Bowl defensive lineman, all year, has not played. And then Tyson Alualu, who is a really good, solid nose guard, has, I think he played a game and a quarter or something like that, and then hurt his knee, on somebody fell on it and hasn't been back. Maybe it was his ankle, I can't remember now, but his leg, let's say, and because somebody fell on him, and he's not played again. And they just don't have enough, they don't have enough capable defensive linemen. They have Cameron Hayward, who is probably the second or third best defensive lineman in the league, and he's having to do the work of three people. And that's too much to ask. I mean, he's doing his job as well as can possibly be done, but run away from him and you meet little resistance. And the inability of the other defensive linemen to affect blocks has made the jobs of the interior, the inside linebackers, nearly impossible. And they've played very poorly. And that's what's been the problem for the Steelers for all, you know, on defense for at least probably since they played Detroit. And Detroit couldn't throw because Jared Goff was hurt. And so they just said, oh, let's run it. And then they found out, hey, this is easy. And that's why that game, you know, other than Ben not playing, wound up in a tie. And so that's been the Vikings, the Chargers, I mean, the Bengals, they've all kind of steamrolled through that line and made it difficult for the Steelers. The Chargers, you know, the Chiefs had success with that as well. Maybe not to the degree that the others did, but also because they didn't need to. They were able to throw the ball as well.
So you're predicting do you think Pittsburgh, because, you know, it was like you said, it was 36-10 last time, and the Chiefs didn't have Travis Kelce, didn't have Nick Bolton, Tyreek Hill was on a limited number of snaps. Do you expect a more competitive game, or is this just a bad matchup for Pittsburgh?
I think it's a bad matchup, but I'm hopeful for a more competitive game because of the circumstances. It's a very difficult opponent for them, but I'm just hopeful. You know, in the same way that I was hopeful, you know, when everybody was saying that Jacksonville had no chance against the Colts, I still hoped. I didn't want to watch it because I didn't want to, you know, try sit there and root for a team that had won two games prior to that. But I'd had hope, at least, that maybe they could, you know, get lucky or whatever. And that's about what I expect. I don't make predictions on the Steelers. I just, you know, I look at it and I know it's going to be difficult. But I also, at the beginning of the year, didn't think they would win against Buffalo in Buffalo, and they did. So I have some hope, but I am fully aware that the Chiefs are a far superior team.
All right, Mike, let's transition to some college basketball. And last night, Baylor, the last undefeated team in college basketball, went down to Texas Tech. And Stephen and I spent a lot of time in the first hour talking about, man, looking across the Big 12, this race seems maybe as wide open as ever. And I'm curious, first of all, just off the top, do you see it that way? I mean, what are your overall thoughts on just the initial landscape of the Big 12 right now?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it wide open. I would call it daunting. I still think the champion's going to come from probably Kansas and Baylor, and then maybe, you know, I can't see anybody else winning it.
Okay.
But every night will be a challenge, just about, especially on the road. But pretty much every night's going to be a challenge for whoever plays. There just aren't any bad teams in the league. I don't think Oak State is what they would have been if they had the full incentive that everybody else had. I think that probably took a little bit of, you know, a few miles an hour off their fastball, because that little extra of, you know, what you can get out of this season isn't there for them. But they still have a very capable team. And everybody else has a shot, and I mean, a real shot. Now, Kansas State, I don't think they have quite the offensive weapons. They certainly play their tails off. I will be stunned if they don't beat at least two NCAA tournament teams at Bramlage. So they're going to win some league games. They are they are a good team, just not enough firepower. And in another league, the A and heck in the ACC, they might even be a first division contender with where the ACC is or the Pac-12. But there's just not enough firepower, I don't think. But everybody else in that league has a shot to make it to March, and I think everybody else is really dangerous. I just don't know that anybody else is going to be consistent enough with their effort, with their performance, with the challenge of playing in their gym as to take down either Baylor, most likely Baylor, but also with KU as a outside contender.
So Texas Tech, they got wins over Kansas and Baylor now in back-to-back games, and we've got coaching changes at Texas Tech, Iowa State, Oklahoma. They've all got impressive wins so far this year. Iowa State is off to a tough start because of the schedule, but I guess I'm a little curious what you think of the hires of those three coaches and the trajectory of those three teams, Texas Tech, Iowa State, and Oklahoma so far.
Well, I think the one that I was most concerned about was Oklahoma because you're really changing a lot there. Not necessarily, you're going from one really capable coach to a borderline Hall of Fame in Lon Kruger to another who's done a fabulous job, Porter Moser at Loyola, and built a winning concept there so effectively that it's continued on without him. And without their best player from a year ago as well, Cameron Crutwig. So it shows that he's really capable. But you don't know how the new group is going to react. They had some guys transfer out. Brady Manick left. So I didn't know whether or not that was going to succeed, at least in the near term, and it is. Mark Adams, I read someone say on Saturday that Chris Beard had taken the Texas Tech culture with him, and I'm like, what I read was that that Mark Adams has continued the Chris Beard culture, and I'm like, I'm not sure that that's really true. Remember Chris Beard at Little Rock? They played up tempo, they pressed, they ran, they squeezed the ball off you, and then they get to Texas Tech, and all of a sudden they're like this half court defensive firepower, you can't stop them, you can't score against them. Excuse me, and I thought, am I sure that it's not that this particular culture at Texas Tech isn't Mark Adams' culture? Not that Chris isn't a great coach. I mean, he's shown that because he's succeeded at a high level at two places and is on his way to doing it a third. But I think that this Texas Tech is Mark Adams' Texas Tech, and so you're seeing that on the floor. I said on Big Ten Basketball and Beyond on Sunday night, I think that, using the old boxing analogy, pound for pound, I think they're the best defensive team in the country.
Wow.
I think they execute defensively better than anybody does. They're really hard to play against, and they have great game plans. Last night they if you look at the box score and you see Akinjo and Flagler score 17 each, and you think, well, on a day like that, shouldn't Baylor be successful? Well, that's all that happened. They didn't let anybody else score. I mean, they stopped every single other player on the floor practically. L.J. Crier got 10 in 29 minutes, only got 9 shots. Almost no one else on the team could get a shot off. They couldn't score because they couldn't get shots. And they had a really good game plan. They made it. They got Akinjo got 14 shots, but he only made 5. And Flagler got only 11 shots. He scored, he made 5 of 8 from 3, but it wasn't enough because no one else could get any shots. I just think that he does a magnificent job of designing defense. And the question for him long term is, can you get enough good players in there? Out to Lubbock, to play defense, to be consistently good in the league. But in the short term, he's got those guys, and they are doing those things. And I was really impressed by each of the last two performances.
We have Mike DeCourcy from the Sporting News. Boy, it was a wild finish to that game last night. between Kansas and Iowa State and went back and forth. You think Iowa State's going to win? You think Kansas is going to win? And then Iowa State got a pretty good look at it. I thought it was going in when it left his hand. But what was your reaction to the frantic finish last night at Allen Fieldhouse?
Yeah, you know, the first thing I thought about when that was over was, yeah, it was a good look, right? But with the way things were going, and you're only down one, so a two wins the game, wouldn't you have rather had the ball in Brockington's hands? And how do you make that happen? Well, it helps if you call a timeout. I know a lot of people prefer not to get the defense set, and there are lots of occasions that show that in a circumstance like that, trying to score in a scramble has been effective. But I like the idea that I'm in control of my destiny, so to speak. I'm in the control of what I can make happen, and not so much worry about what, you know, well, if I do this, the defense is going to be set. Yes, they're going to be set, but so is the offense. I mean, in that case, that it was not a bad shot, but it wasn't the shot you'd want to win the game. Kalscher was having a great night. I get it, but one, he's shooting a shot he doesn't need to shoot because he only needs 2 points to win, and he shot from three. And again, I don't blame him for taking the shot because they didn't have time once they made the decision not to call timeout. They didn't have time. It was get the ball to the first open shooter, and he was it. But Gabe's not, you know, not the most consistent 3-point shooter. I mean, he shoots in the 20s. He's having a really effective year for them, but he shoots in the 20s, and that's not far from where he shot for his career. So would I rather have the ball in Brockington's hands, trying to create a pull up that Kansas hadn't stopped in the second half, or would I rather have Gabe Kalscher for an open three? So, and this is not being critical. This is more of a philosophy debate, kind of like, do you foul at the end of regulation if you're up three, that kind of thing. And for me, when that ball missed, you know, I'm looking for where is Brockington? So, you know, what would he have done in that moment with as effective as he had been in, really, I mean, it was almost all him down the stretch, you know, in that trade-off going back and forth. It was like Kansas would score and then Brockington would score. You know, Kansas had like six different guys that could score down that stretch. But for Iowa State, it was Brockington who made the difference, and then he was not able to impact the final possession just because of circumstance.
And then, like you said, it's, you know, not exactly being critical, but I told Nate in the segment before he came on the show, man, I do not like it when teams settle for a three when they're only down one, especially if they've had success, you know, in the mid-range or even driving the basketball. And you saw, what did Kansas, how did they win the game? Trying to get to the rim, you know, Igbaji gets to the free throw line, and then you had that great shot that ended up winning the game. And, you know, I think too many times teams, and look, in transition, like you said, when it's a scramble, you're getting whatever shot you can, but yeah, call a timeout, reset it, whatever. But you're down one. It's not always your best shot settling for a three when you don't need it.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of what players either are trained or train themselves to do now, is to look first at the perimeter. I watched like six games last night, and I can't remember which one was which, but I saw a team had a 3-on-1 break and shot a three. 3-on-1. I mean, you shoot on a 3-on-1, you're going to shoot probably 95% on your layups. That's like almost a guaranteed 2 points. An open three is, you know, a wide open three is probably a 50-50 shot. And it wasn't like it was a close game, so it wasn't like they desperately needed every three they could get. It's just that's how they play. And I just don't, you know, 3-on-1? No, I mean, but that's what they look first to. How do you get it outside to an open shooter? And that's, you know, basketball now, and I don't agree with that in certain circumstances. I understand why it's done, but in certain circumstances, I can't buy the idea that a 95% layup is a inferior shot to a 50% three. It's mathematically it's not, and so I think that's the same concept here. You know, I have had so much success with this one particular player. He's been so hard for the opposition to guard don't I at least want to try to make him a factor on the play, even if it's him giving up the ball because he forces defensive action and it opens somebody for one of those 95% layups? I just want him to have an impact on that final possession if I can. And in that circumstance, and again, lots of probably more coaches do it that the way that they that was done last night, which is don't allow the defense to have a handle on this. Let's just go. And I think that you turn by just going, you turn 7 seconds, which is a lot of time on a possession, especially you know when you're bringing it up. I mean, we've seen teams with. You know, inbound after stoppages with 4 or 5 seconds and get good shots. 7 seconds is a ton of time. And so I would rather see in that situation the ball brought up, you know, and run something that's in your playbook, so to speak. And then if, like I said, if Brockington gets the ball and he's on the elbow where he is just brutally lethal, if he gets that ball there and then KU throws two guys at him, then, okay, then maybe you can lob it over the top for a layup or something like that. I mean, there are just a lot of different ways that you could go in that situation.
So let's talk about big picture stuff when it comes to this game itself, Mike. And one of the storylines for KU is the fact that KJ Adams got the start over Mitch Lightfoot and David McCormick. And David McCormick a couple games ago looked like he had responded to getting benched by Bill Self and had a big game, but the last two games... Again, last night, 10 minutes, only 1 point. Mitch Lightfoot, I don't think anybody expects major production out of him, but he's a good, I guess, a good solid, you know, bench option. How important is it for Kansas to figure out that position for David McCormick to be the kind of guy that they thought he was going to be this year? Or can they still accomplish a lot with this situation the way it is right now with McCormick's kind of, you know, fledgling a little bit?
Well, you know, I think that it depends on what you want to accomplish. I mean, if you're asking me, can you win the national championship with 6'7 and 6'8 in your front court, my answer is emphatically no. I mean, not unless you want to, you've got a time machine taking us back to 1943. I mean, that's not how it works. You got to have size. You got to have impact physically. It is a different game now, but that you're still not seeing champions that don't have at least one physically imposing player in the front court. You know, stopping the ball at the rim is still a factor. You want to do that. And KJ Adams did a really nice job of that, getting 2 blocks in 10 minutes last night. And even Mitch, you know, getting 3 and 20. So that's still, that's helpful, certainly, but you're not playing against, let's say, Kofi Coburn in that game. Or you know, look around the country. You're not playing against someone like UCLA, which has multiple low post options. And that's not what Iowa State tends to do. They don't force the ball inside as much as some others. So this was a good matchup in order to try to make a point with someone like KJ and with Mitch playing 20 and David only getting 10. I'm kind of at a loss to what it is that makes David go in and out. And I'm sure that I'm not sure, but I imagine that Bill probably is as well, because he's been dealing with this for more than two seasons now. You know, there's more there. He's a really physically capable player, and he just seems to struggle with being able to be. Able to be consistently there, consistently present, consistently emphatic. It starts with that, and then the second step to that is being in the right places, not just being physically, imposing, but being in the right places, understanding how to impact the opposition. I know he's been coached on all those things because he's worked with in a program that has been. That has turned out some of the best big guys in recent college basketball history. And not always, you know, starting with the five-star foundation. Sometimes it's, you know, it's someone like a Jeff Withey who builds into being a brilliant college basketball player. So I think that they have to make it happen if they want to be great, and I know they want to be great. They can win. Can you win in this league playing the way they did? Well, they did last night. But I just don't see how you can expect to win the biggest games, the ones in March, without having the kind of front court presence that David gives you when he's playing well.
Mike DeCourcy is our guest. Hey, Mike, Mizzou beat a ranked team on Saturday at home. They beat Alabama. And now tonight they play at Arkansas. And Arkansas, all of a sudden, after a really good start to the season, they've lost five of their last six games, including their first three conference games against Mississippi State, Vanderbilt, and Texas A&M. And so they're 0-3 in the conference. Mizzou's 1-1, but you know, Arkansas is still favored by 14. It's at Arkansas. What about Mizzou's win over Alabama and maybe their chance to at least be competitive against a struggling Arkansas team tonight?
Yeah, I think the first thing is obviously taking the confidence gained from the Mizzou's victory over Alabama, which was maybe as big an upset as we've had in league play this year, and then taking that on the road, being able to transpose it to Bud Walton Arena, I think that's the first thing. Interesting about Arkansas is that they are a small team. I mean, they have great size in the front court, don't get me wrong. I mean, but they play really small guards. J.D. Notte, their leading scorer, 6'1", 6'2". Chris Likes is 5'7", 5'8", something like that. I mean, if I can post you up, you're small. They don't field a big perimeter, and so that's something that they've struggled with, and that's one of the reasons why they haven't been very effective defensively, is that the length that their system depends upon hasn't been there. They're not able to disrupt as much as they usually do. That's what their key was when they made the Sweet 16 last season, was, you know, how disruptive they were and how they were able to throw a bunch of bodies at you, and they don't really have that now. And so, a team that a year ago was really effective defensively is now 267th in effective field goal percentage in defense. I mean, if you play against them, you should score. You should be able to score. Opposition shoots really well against them from 3-point range. Again, why? Because when you have small guards, the closeout isn't as impactful. You're not looking at a long arm that's coming up toward you. You're looking at a guy who's trying to reach up but maybe can't get up to where you are with your jump shot. And so that, I think that's really impacted Arkansas. You know, you talked about a good start to the season, but They didn't beat anybody that's going to the tournament as an invited team. Penn wins the Ivy League or Central Arkansas wins their league or whatever. But they didn't beat anybody in that 9-0 start that is going to be invited to the NCAAs on merit. So the beginning of the season was deceptive for them, and once they started playing major powers like Oklahoma, major conference teams like Oklahoma, Mississippi State, Vanderbilt, and such, they have not been at all effective. So, I mean, if Mizzou plays tonight like they played Saturday, they should win. But it's the element of can you do those things on the road that you did at home. It's obviously much more difficult.
So, Mike, Kansas State takes on TCU tonight, and K-State looking for their first win in Big 12 play. They've been battling COVID issues. They've played a couple of really close games, but I know they feel like they need to get on the winning side of something. What kind of a challenge stands in front of them with TCU tonight?
Well, TCU is a team that has played very well for their start of the season, and again, not an overwhelmingly daunting schedule early, but as it's increased a little bit They've still played better. I mean, they played, you know, major conference teams like Utah and Georgetown. Again, still not real NCAA tournament caliber teams. I think this is an opportunity for K-State. Again, you get a team in your gym that has NCAA tournament ambitions, but that has not yet faced significant opposition and or significant opposition on the road. And I like what I've seen from Kansas State. I just don't know if there's enough there. Again, I think they showed that they have a really great they have a great character within their team. You give them two more really good players, or maybe even one high level scorer, and I think they'd be a team that could make the NCAAs. That player's not there, so they have to sort of fight and scrap, and they've done that. And obviously, like you said, they've had some issues that have kept them from having a full roster on game night, and that's impacted them as well. But I look at TCU, and they've got several transfers on their team. Damian Baugh, their point guard, as a transfer, came in from Memphis. They've also got some players who have been with them for a little while, like Mike Miles and Chuck O'Bannon. I do think that it's the kind of game that K-State is going to feel like this is our opportunity. This is our chance to get on the winning side and maybe start to build something, not just in terms of the character of the team, but actually getting successful results on the floor as well.
Mike DeCourcy has been our guest. Mike, thank you so much for the time. Let us know if you plan a last-minute trip to Kansas City for the game on Sunday night. If not, we'll talk to you next week.
All right, I'm not, I love you guys, but I'm not wishing you good luck. I wish you good health, but I'm not going to wish you good luck this weekend.
Right, and I hope that Sunday's the last time I ever see Ben Roethlisberger play football. So, But Mike, I love you, okay? That's all. I'm still mad about 2016. Sorry. That's Mike DeCourcy from the Sporting News, who joins us. Yeah, I just saw I was looking through some Steeler stuff, and I saw someone, I don't know, posted a still shot of Tomlin shaking Andy Reid's hand after that game, and I've been triggered now. So now I'm very angry. That feeling is sickening. We'll be back after this on Sports Radio 810 WHB.